Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Looking for Love in All the Wrong Dust Jackets, a show where three disgruntled harpies talk to you about everything we love in romance, whether that's books, movies, TV shows, whatever we like. My name's Liz.
I'm Danny.
I'm Wiggles.
And welcome to the show. Today, we are discussing the book Even Though I Knew the End by C.L. Polk. But before we get into that, I do gots to warn ya. I gots to let the people know that we are crass and unhinged. We swear a whole gosh darn bunch, and we like to talk about the naughty times. So if you're not into that, I totally get it, but you've been warned.
Yeah, so figure yourself out.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, what have you guys been up to? Get me caught up. Tell me about your lives.
I read jack shit because I have been binge watching Resident Alien. So like before I was like, oh, I'm just going to dip my toe in. Oh, that's nice. And I spent a good portion of this last weekend. I am halfway through season two.
I'm so behind. I don't think we've even started watching season two. Season one was really good.
It's a good time.
Yeah.
Lots of laughs, which I need. I need to emulate joy.
Oh, God. Fucking weirdo.
What the fuck was that?
Oh, no. So, yeah. That's what I've been doing.
I read Reborn yesterday by Tessa Bailey, which is the first in her, I think it's Phenomenal Fate series. It's her vampire romance series, which I was super excited for because I love Tessa Bailey. However,
oh no,
it was a womp womp.
No,
it was a big old womp womp. I honestly would have DNF'd it. Had I not paid for it and felt like the obligation to keep reading it. Yeah, so it was like a 2-star.
Damn.
Because I got through it. I can't give it 1-star, I guess. I don't know. The rules are made up and the points don't matter. You could just tell that like it wasn't working. There was a lot of moments where I was like, what is happening now? Why is this here? Where did this person come from? Who are these people?
I think a lot of authors would like to dip their toe into paranormal, but just because it looks the same as regular romance does not mean it is the same as regular romance.
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah. And I thought at first as I was reading it, I was like, oh, is this one of her like way older books? Because it kind of feels like not a seasoned author wrote it. And she wrote it in 2020, which makes me think like, no.
Mm.
No.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I'll just go back to reading her contemporary.
Mm.
Fair enough.
Danny?
So I had a weekend where I was like, I need familiar spice. And so I actually reread Deceived by the Gargoyles.
Not a bad choice, though.
Correct. So I reread that, and I was watching a bunch of cooking shows, because of course I was. And then today I started listening to Part of Your World by Abby Jimenez, and I'm really excited about this book. So far, I'm really enjoying it. I see in the future me reading a lot more of her stuff.
Part of Your World. Like, okay, Yours Truly was great. It was.
Yes.
Part of Your World was like that notch above. I fucking love that one.
She just released her third book in that series.
Correct. It's definitely the only thing I'm debating now is like, do I want to do physical copy or do I want to do audio? Because I did audio for Part of Your World, but I did physical for Yours Truly. And normally I don't mix it up like that. So now I'm fucked because I got to like make a decision and I'm not good at that.
Maybe you should split the difference and just buy the shelf trophy for Part of Your World and then also get the new book and read that physically.
I have thought about that. However, the voice actors that are on all of the series are really fucking good.
They are indeed. Yes.
So I'm at a split, but I know I am going to read it this summer. Like that's not debatable.
I have been debating. I don't often buy myself the shelf trophy. I listen to a lot of the books, especially that we do for the podcast. I listen to a lot of them because ADHD is a bitch and sitting still is weird for me. So I have to be doing 8 things at a time. But I have been debating. I'm like, I think for her books, I might need the shelf trophy.
Mm-hmm.
I hate buying things twice.
Mm-hmm.
And I hate if I've like rented the book or like borrowed the book from the library or through Libby or whatever. I hate then spending the money on something that like I'm probably not going to reread. Even if I really liked it, I might not reread it. So I have a hard time with that.
I have a pretty good like judgment factor of whether or not I'm going to reread at least part of a book again.
Yeah, sure.
So for example, like I don't think I've ever truly read Jane Eyre twice, but I've read so many parts over again that I might as well have. But so there's like, that's why most of my bookshelves are honestly comprised of TBR or like the very select few that I'm like, I might read this again someday because I donate the ones that I'm not because I'd rather put them back into circulation.
Yeah.
And I pick up while I'm donating other people's donated books and I carry them back to my house like a little hermit, like, ooh, look at my little finds that I found, my treasure.
I don't often buy myself the book trophy, which is why when I'm like, for her books, I might do that.
I'm a hoarder, though. So the other side of the coin of me not wanting to spend money is I hoard books. So it's a
fair enough.
It's a tough battle here. I don't get collector's editions. Like, I don't understand that. I don't understand them.
I could see getting it for a book that I truly loved.
Mm-hmm.
But right? If I spent that much money on a book, I'm not going to want to like read it then. Because then it's too pretty. And what if I damage it with my slopness?
I mean, be less slobby?
You never know what's going to happen, man.
Yes. All of these could like get water damage at some point and I'd have to throw them all out. It'd be very sad. But, you know, that's life.
I mean, I bought a really pretty version of The Secret Garden because I am obsessed with that book.
Also, anyway. Usually those editions are made with better materials than a paperback. So there's also like that kind of thing to it. Whereas I know that my paperbacks honestly have a far more limited shelf life than something that's hardcover and has sprayed edges to protect them and all that kind of thing.
Like, I get why other people do it. I just wouldn't probably do it myself.
There's a lot of things that I'm like, I totally get why you would do that, that I don't have much interest in. For example, I don't need a signed copy. Would I be like, oh, this is really nice? Sure. If it's a book I already love.
Yeah.
But like, if it's like, hey, this is an author I've read before and this is a signed copy of that book, that doesn't appeal to me in any way, shape, or form. What if I don't like that book? What if I love the rest of their collection and I'm like, this is the worst book?
Well, I have been watching a lot on the TikToks about the massive failure that was Readers Take Denver.
That's the one. Yeah.
And like, if you love going to those book conventions and bringing like 12, 15, 20 books for all of these authors to sign, like definitely more power to you. I don't get the appeal personally.
I don't either.
No, I wouldn't be willing to like haul that shit around.
Right.
Just to contextualize how much I hate hauling shit around. Halloween, right? Often, in order for your character to make sense, they have to have a prop. If my character, if like the costume I have chosen requires a prop, then I'm not choosing that costume.
Yeah, no, I was exactly the same way. I really don't dress up for Halloween anymore, but
no.
Mm-mm.
No.
Unless I wear a tiara, in which case I am my normal self in a tiara.
You're welcome.
You're welcome. I have a gorgeous tiara. I bought it at a con. I spent way too much money on it. And
now you got to get some use out of it.
Yeah. During COVID, I was feeling very, which this is weird for me because I am totally like, I can live in my apartment and stay in there all the time. But I was feeling very closed in and I needed to feel special. And so I needed to take the trash out. And I took the trash out in my tiara.
There you go. I don't hoard many things. Like, honestly, there are very few items where I would be really pissed off if I had to give them up. But everything else, I'm like, it could all just be taken away by somebody else and I'd be fine. But the one thing I do hoard and I'm really bad about this, is art and office supplies.
Oh, I know. I've seen your...
Oh, yeah.
You've seen, yes. and I found this woman on TikTok who gets me. She's like, has a whole thing of pens and like is breaking them down on TikTok based on like their clickability and the way they roll. And I'm like, somebody who knows me.
Oh, no.
I would have like a whole room dedicated to art supplies. It would be amazing.
I do have a whole room dedicated to like my cross stitch supplies and stuff. I have a lot of cross stitch supplies. And yet every time I start a pattern, I'm missing like 12 colors.
Great.
I don't know how that works.
Anyway, so we were here to talk about, I don't know, what was it? A book?
It is a book. Yes.
Yeah, it's a book.
What is this book?
Well, before I tell you about the book, I'll tell you about the author.
Okay.
Well, let's get back to the book here. So C.L. Polk is the author of the World Fantasy Award winning novel Witchmark, the first novel of the Kingston cycle. After leaving high school early, they have worked as a film extra, sold vegetables on the street, and identified exotic insect species for a vast collection of a word I can't pronounce before settling down to write Silver Fork fantasy novels. What does Silver Fork fantasy novels mean?
I don't know. Is that a series?
No, it's not written like that.
I'm going to Google it. The period between 1820 and 1845 witnessed the rise of the fashionable novel or social satire. This genre, which aimed to depict elegant and aristocratic manners in detail, was named the Silver Fork Novels by William Hazlitt in 1827 after the upper class practice of eating fish with two silver forks.
Wow. Look at us learning.
Yeah.
Okay. Polk lives near the Bow River in Calgary, Alberta, in a tiny apartment with too many books and a yarn stash that could last a decade. They ride a green bicycle with a basket on the front. They spend too much time on Twitter, which is now X. But
I'm that only with TikTok. Only, obviously, not for much longer. Congress! Anyway. Danny, why don't you tell me what this book is about?
Okay, so this book is about a warlock who sold her soul to a devil, mm-hmm, or a demon, to save her brother's life. And she is now knowing that she had 10 years from that point until she dies.
Mm-hmm.
And she is coming up on that point, and she has been saving money and everything so that her girlfriend could move away and everything and get what she wants in life. And then she's preparing to die. She hasn't told her girlfriend that she's going to die or anything. She's just getting ready for it. She has a couple of days left, and then she takes a job she kind of is a private detective-ish thing. Mm-hmm. You get private dick vibes from it. And she's trying to solve these murders. Are you laughing at the word private dick?
Yes. I was keeping it contained.
And so she starts a one last job. She's like, okay, here's the thing. If you find out who does this, I will give you $1,000 and your soul back.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun. Discuss.
Yeah, so this book is super short. It's about 130-ish pages, or about like 3 hours on audiobook if you don't speed it up.
Mm-hmm.
Or 4 hours, something like that. But there's a lot of stuff to talk about in this short little buddy.
It is. It's very like, it's like when you have grape juice concentrate, you know, it's like it's all packed in there. You're going to get a lot more juice than just what's in the can.
That's true.
God, what the hell of a reference there.
Welcome.
Oh, gosh.
I'm here to help the people understand the book, and you're welcome.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
When was this? Like, what is this time period? Is it the 1940s?
30s.
30s? Okay. Yep.
In between the wars.
Okay. Mm-hmm. In between the wars.
The big place markers in history.
Let's talk about what Helen's relationship is with her brother and how that's, like, shaping all of this. Because that's the first thing we really get to see.
Yeah.
Is Helen is in pursuit of this next case that she's considering taking on but hasn't taken on yet, and is taking pictures of a crime scene when her brother and another member of his order show up and are like, nah, this is our case, beat it, we're done with your shit. And her brother is like, you're a fucking asshole because you sacrificed your soul to save me, so stop being evil.
And we find out that she's pretty much at the end of her 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So 10 years ago, they were in some sort of accident. I think it was a car accident. Her parents died. Her brother died. She lived. She gave up her soul to bring her brother back. But they haven't talked like at all in the last 10 years.
Well, and part of that is because her brother, immediately upon resuming his body, if you will, proceeds to rat her out as mm-hmm. having done this, which means that they have to kick her out of their order because they, this book does really heavily rely on Christian dogma as its base.
Mm-hmm.
So you have angels and devils, you have heaven and hell, and that whole dichotomy. And so because she has sacrificed her soul, no matter what, she's doomed to go to hell. And so they wouldn't want her in their holy order, right?
Yeah, their holy order of mages and mystics.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Which is the Brotherhood of the Compass. The one kind of bummer I had about this book is because it's so short, we get just tiny little snippets of this world building,
mm-hmm.
like just teeny tiny pieces, such as when they talk about the Brotherhood of the Compass and the mystics of the compass, they reference that as a woman, you can only join if you have a male family member who can kind of essentially sponsor you.
Mm-hmm.
So even though Helen, kind of from what we can read, is a pretty powerful like warlock. Alicia talks about like creating all these wards and stuff that seems like you would have to be more powerful to take down. She could only have joined because her brother was in it. And then she got kicked out.
And she wouldn't have been a warlock in their order.
No.
And honestly, that's a... it's a big plot point, but something we get like very little information about, speaking to what you're saying, where the only time we find out that warlock is like considered a bad term there is her brother flat out asks her if the magic she uses is warlock magic, rather than whatever magic they're tapping into. And she's like, no, I can't believe you think I would do that. And he's like, well, you are a warlock. And she's like, yeah, but I'm still not evil.
Yeah.
So it's very much like warlocks are bad guys, apparently. But we don't ever meet another warlock. We don't have any further information about them.
The impression I kind of got is that so the higher ups, basically, of the order and everything kind of, I think they kind of want people to assume that anybody who uses magic outside of the order is kind of considered bad.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Whereas that is not the case. Magic is, you know, good, and but there are good and bad parts of magic, just like there are good and bad people, and it's how you use it. And so it's, he kind of had the, well, did you use warlock magic to do this? And it's like, well, no, fuck you. Like, I'm a warlock, so kind of, but I didn't use any baneful magic, if that's what you're getting at.
Right. Well, it kind of gave me the same feeling. If you've played the Dragon Age series, there are Tower Mages and then there are Apostates.
Yeah.
And so Tower Mages are under the thumb of the Chantry, which is the church, right? And they have people there to control them and make sure that they don't get too powerful. They put them through this whole like testing ceremony that if they fail, then they like basically lobotomize them. And it felt like that. It felt very much like you're only allowed to practice magic and not be evil if you're doing it the way we tell you you're allowed to do it.
Pretty much. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Another reason, though, kind of getting back to Ted or Teddy, as he's sometimes called, which is cute. Another factor that Ted brings up is that he was in heaven when she pulled him back down to earth. Mm-hmm. So like that's also a thing of contention with between the siblings, is that he could have happily just stayed there, mm-hmm. and like waited for her to come, mm-hmm. to heaven, and she could have shown up and her whole family is there waiting for her, right? But instead she decided she couldn't have that and had to have him back on earth, is how he sees it.
Yeah.
And so now she's damned herself to never being able to go to heaven.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how old Helen is supposed to be. Do they ever say?
I don't remember them saying it explicitly, but yeah, I assumed mid-20s.
Yeah.
Okay. I guess I was assuming a little bit older, but still, if you go back 10 years and let's say she was 20 or 16 or whatever when mm-hmm. her entire family died,
mm-hmm.
you're usually not thinking long-term like that. You're not seeing a 16-year-old that's like, okay, I've lost everyone, but it's all right because in 60 years or whenever I die, I'll see them again.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's not,
that's not how your brain go.
Yeah. No, no. And honestly, her reaction makes total sense because she also lost them in an instant.
Right.
You know, it wasn't like I've slowly lost these people throughout my life. It was all at once. My whole family's gone.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the devil would only allow her to bring one person back.
Because she only had her own soul to bargain with. So right. She didn't have anything to trade for the other two.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and if you also look at it from the lens of the 1930s, and we get a lot of the sexism, especially talk about like the brotherhood and the fact that she couldn't be a powerful like order member or whatever. There's also that lens to it of mm-hmm. like, but what do I do? Because I'm not allowed to do things in this world as a mm-hmm. woman.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's touched on throughout the book that all of the things basically that were true of the USA 1930s are true in this universe. Just mm-hmm. because yeah. there's magic and all of that does not negate any of that. So there's moments where it's really clear that the racism is still clear. It's very clearly established that it is taboo for Edith and Helen to have their relationship together. Mm-hmm. So, you know, she has a lot of extra complications that Ted would never understand.
Right.
Absolutely.
Which I think is just a really good kind of theme of the book is Ted not understanding until the end,
mm-hmm.
which
mm-hmm.
we'll get at, mm-hmm. get to when we talk about the end.
Yeah. I will say the cool thing about the way that she wrote this book is it does feel like you're stepping into that time period in history.
Oh yeah. I very mm-hmm. much felt it.
Mm-hmm.
I did feel it, but it also was a little jarring at points because there were just like phrases and terms that are not used today.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would just go, I have no idea what you're talking about, lady. Like she referenced her iron all the time. And I was like, is that a gun? Because I know that guns can be called that. What are you talking about?
Yeah, they did use some slang of the time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I felt like a lot of it I could infer with context, or if I'm being honest, I watched a lot of Turner Classic Movies when I was a kid. So that also has permeated into my brain.
The one sure. that helped me was I listened to a lot of 30s radio shows as a kid.
Wow, you're even weirder than I am.
So in my defense, for a present at one point, my parents got my grandparents on cassette tapes, these 30s radio shows. And when we went on car trips, like when we drove across the state and everything, they would put these in. And they are fucking hilarious. And I still listen to them now. We don't have the cassette tapes anymore, but I may have found them on like Amazon Music and stuff. The commercials are fantastic. The specific one that I really enjoy listening to is The Shadow, and the commercials for that are always about blue coal, and they're always like, it's the Pennsylvania anthracite that's colored a harmless blue at the mine, so for easy identification. I'm like, is it though? Was it harmless to color coal that you're gonna burn in your house blue?
I guarantee you it wasn't.
I guarantee you it wasn't. I'm pretty sure that caused a lot of cancer. But it's hilarious. They're so fun to listen to. And that's where some of those, I didn't even pick up that they were using them sometimes because I was like, oh yeah, I listened to The Shadow. And I love The Shadow.
All right.
I'm sorry.
I will also say that I felt like just the prose in general was sometimes a little bit harder for me to follow. And maybe it's just because I'm used to reading more novels where everything just takes a little bit longer, both in descriptions of things and actual action and all of that. Whereas because this was short, things just happened so quickly, which also meant transitions between beats happened very, very quickly.
It's really clear that the style of this book was emulating film noir, and it almost felt like it should have been a movie instead of a book because cutscenes don't work the same way in a movie as they do in a book. And it felt like they were aiming for that style, but readers kind of don't have that training to react to it that way.
Right.
I could see that. I also... From the way, not necessarily the language, but like the pacing of the book, I also got 1930s radio from it, very much so, which honestly is a big compliment.
Yeah, I think it was really successful in what it was trying to do. But I think if you're going to approach it from that standpoint, the thought has to be, I need to probably branch out from that a little bit in order to fit what the reader is used to. So I mean, the consequence is obviously that the book is very short, and it didn't need to be. There are plenty of places where could have been fleshed out.
That again is probably just one of my big complaints, is I feel like the book should have been like twice as long. And I read the book and you guys listened to it, so I don't know if that changes my perception on some of those transitions a little bit, because I think when you are trying to make really harsh transitions in books, and I had the same issue when we read Bride by Allie Hazelwood, is if you don't create like a physical separation, and it can't just be like a chapter break, because especially nowadays with romance novels, we're just like chapter breaking or like having new chapters constantly. But even just having like that extra space that indicates like we are entering a new scene, this is a scene break, or, you know, having more chapters because it makes sense. And I kept saying chapter break before, I meant paragraph break. We have more paragraph breaks in romance novels.
Fair enough. Yeah, I can see that. And I do think that actually us listening to it and you reading it does bring different perspectives, which is kind of something I like, because I didn't notice things as much because I listened to it. I just felt the kind of slightly jauntiness that is 1930s radio shows. That's actually very much the impression I got in while listening to this, is the like thing that very much was a thing back then.
It did feel, though, even listening to it, that it was going by really quickly, which does again fit the style that was being aimed for. So it's sort of like a double-edged sword. And so you kind of have to also ask the question, like, can you challenge your readers? And I think that this author successfully did that. Like, I don't have to be kowtowed to all the time, you know?
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, I think I would be much more prepared to read their novels in the future. I think it's just the blind of going into it the first time.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I did expect something fast. It's a short book. Like, it's what it's probably going to be, pretty fast. I do think that one of the things that the author did successfully in kind of skipping over having to give you lore is using very familiar lore.
Absolutely.
Right. We're talking about crossroad demons. Like, she literally says at one point in time when she was dying from the car accident, she crawled to the crossroad to make her deal for 10 years. I don't want to say most people, but a lot of people are familiar with that concept. You know, talking about even mentioning things like left hand versus right hand magic, even the term the White City Devil, or the, yeah, was the White City Vampire.
Yes.
In my head, I was just like, oh, the devil in the White City, which is an entirely different thing.
Yep.
But it just kept, but it is from that kind of same time. And it kept triggering my brain to go to familiar places.
Right. Well, and this feels like the perfect opportunity to bring up the fact that it also had a lot of similarities to the lore that Supernatural uses.
The TV show Supernatural. Yes. An insane amount.
Yes.
I was like, oh, did we just write like Supernatural in noir style, but with two female leads instead of two male leads?
Maybe. It did kind of feel like that sometimes. Helen did have some similarities to Dean Winchester.
Yeah.
In terms of personality and attitude.
And just general fuckuppery.
Yes. Yes. That said, I want to be clear. The lore that Supernatural pulls into its show is not originated by Supernatural.
No.
Most of it. Some of it, like what they've built out since they've taken the lore, yes. But things like angels and devils fighting on Earth, not new.
A woman in white.
Right, not new.
Not new.
All these kinds of things. The ability for both angels and devils to possess you, not new, right? But it did have some similarities where I was like, oh, you're a Supernatural fan.
Right. Since we're...
I will say, so because it is such a short book and everything, I do appreciate the fact that this is not a romance novel in the typical sense in where you come in and they meet and build their relationship and everything. Mm-hmm. This is an established relationship that they are in. They are getting ready to, well, one of them thinks they're getting ready to move across the country with each other so that they can live in San Francisco and hopefully live a more open life with each other. The other one knows that she's going to die in like 3 days. But that's beside the point. This is a established relationship. We're not being introduced to the relationship at the same time that the characters are. They pretty much live together. They, you know, spend all their time together. So I kind of appreciated that not having to build the relationship in the book. It's already established.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we still got like really good relationship moments.
Absolutely.
Like them growing, because this book only takes place over just a handful of days, but like they both have to come to terms that they each have been keeping really massive secrets from each other.
Mm-hmm.
We get, you know, a view into what life was like for homosexuality in the 1930s in Chicago, which is heartbreaking.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just those like little chapters where she's talking about like having to hide and then meeting her friend that disappeared at the insane asylum. Like, it was
that
really hard.
Scene hit me weird. I was like, oh no, my heart.
With the electroshock therapy.
Yep.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Aversion therapy.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I wanted to bring up, and I want to go to the end just because like you brought up the fact that they are already in a relationship for at least a couple of years is kind of the vibe I'm getting.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that we get at the end is that Edith, Helen's significant other, dies in this angel battle. Guess.
Yeah.
And Helen has to give her soul back up again to bring Edith back down to Earth. And one of the things that I loved about that scene is a lot of times when we read books where the relationship has just started or it's just starting and they have to make a big sacrifice, it can sometimes feel very like, why are you making such a big sacrifice for somebody you just met?
Right.
Like, why are you Romeo and Julietting this?
Mm-hmm.
But this one felt like it made a lot of sense.
Absolutely.
And like the idea of for Helen living without Edith was again the same as her living without her family when she was younger. It's this kind of like idea of when you've ingratiated yourself so much into each other's lives, how do you separate? And if you have the ability to stop that separation, like, you're gonna do everything to stop it.
Well, and I like that the author gave us a more complex reason for the big bold sacrifice, right? Mm-hmm. Like, yes, the relationship justifies the ends, right?
Yeah.
But Helen's older now. She's matured. If you told her, just hold out, it'll be a hard, long life. That sucks, but hey, you get more life.
Yeah.
So that's great. But now you get to go to heaven, so you can be with Edith forever.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to hold out. I think she would have done it. But then when she looks over at her brother, who is doomed in her mind to go to hell.
Yeah.
Because spoilers, kills an angel. There's no other way that makes sense, because she can't justify the idea of Ted being down in hell by himself. Mm-hmm. I think that said, all I could think is, do you not understand what hell means, or is your hell different? Because the hell then would be like pulling you apart, that you would never actually get to Ted. So there was definitely a moment where I was like, wait. Then, and that's an example of where there was a lot more room for this story to be fleshed out in order for it to make a bit more sense and to be a little bit more, have a little bit more ground beneath its feet.
Well, my thought process on this too is, who's to say that Ted is necessarily going to hell?
Right.
Yes, he did kill an angel. He did. However, that angel was doing evil things.
Right.
So who's to say that God wasn't like, good job, kid, you know, and you don't know until you die.
Well, and the implication is, if the angel who's in Edith's body, what is their name? Harindel?
You're the one who told me.
I forgot already. Okay. That they went to heaven.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right? That's what we know. But it's never implied that Sashia, I think is the
Sashiel.
Sashiel.
The bad angel.
The bad angel. After they died, that they went to heaven. Right? It's implied that they are somewhere else. Whether that's into the void or into hell, who knows? But if they are barred from getting into heaven, you would think that the idea would be then that technically Ted has done something good.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that comes down to the lens of Christianity and probably more importantly Catholicism, which I didn't grow up Catholic, but.
Good times.
Yeah.
By good times.
So good times.
Not good times.
Not at all. Where a lot of those situations are more binary. Mm-hmm. You stab an angel, you go to hell. 1 + 1 = 2.
It would make a lot more sense if Haraniel didn't come into the situation with Edith and Helen fully like thumbs up, I don't give a shit who you have sex with.
Yeah. Their entire world here is uncertain. I mean, like the laws that they have been living by are perhaps not right or accurate to what God or the devil or whatever is in this world cares about. But I think that's probably a statement about humanity and religion and what is right and wrong.
I think my feeling, and I'm not going to tell anybody how to like express their religious trauma. But I think if you're going to invoke Christian ideas or Abrahamic religious ideas, you do need to be conscious of the lore that actually is there and not the lore that, you know, evangelicals perpetuate. Mm-hmm. Because like one of the big ones is whatever laws are on earth, so shall they be in heaven. Right? That's like one that gets thrown around all the time because it is in many texts, right? But so that's sort of a confusing thing for me if you're going to call on so much of this Christian lore and just ignore some of it. And I'm not saying like it didn't work from a story perspective, but then you need to build out your own lore a little bit, you know?
Yeah, it definitely could have been built out more. I do think, though, that it doesn't necessarily change what Helen does because she's making a snap decision with very limited information.
It's true.
I mean, she doesn't feel like it's limited, right? She has the beliefs that she has and the laws that have been told to her. But I'm guessing we're probably supposed to leave the story with the question of, like, what should she really have done in that situation?
It feels to me like this is the beginning of a series.
Yeah.
And it should be like the adventures of Helen the detective from there on out.
Right.
And that eventually she finds another way to get her soul back.
Which, not gonna lie, I would read the shit out of that.
Right?
Oh, for sure.
Right? And I think I'd be more into it too. Like, not that I didn't like this, because I did. I did liked it. I liked it. I did liked it. I did liked it.
Did for like it.
I did for like with the things I read. But I think I'd be more invested if I knew that there would still be more to come, you know?
Yeah. Yes.
Because I'd be like, oh, it's okay if it's a short book. If then I get to read another short book that continues that story, I'm cool with that. I would wish that she could just like sandwich them together and give me one long book. But you know, not everybody likes that. I get that. It's not me. But you know.
But you know.
So let's actually talk about Helen and Edith.
Okay.
We probably should.
Yeah. Considering that their relationship is the center of the story.
Is it though?
I think so.
Okay.
I think that everything Helen is doing is for Edith. And while we don't get to know Edith's perspective, it feels very much like Edith that's doing the same.
Well, Helen does say pretty much right at the beginning of the book that she's putting everything away to give to Edith.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't know it at the time yet, but that's because she's going to die in a couple days.
Right.
So she has like $5,000 saved up.
Which is a lot of money for that time.
Oh my period. God, it's so much.
Yeah.
She said $5,000 and I was like, girl.
Holy shit.
Save up $5,000 now.
Right? Fuck, man. $5,000 in this economy?
In this economy. Yeah, so we get to meet Edith at the bar, and I like got their relationship immediately. Mm-hmm. I thought that was really well portrayed. Like immediately talking about their like the first time they met at this bar, this like underground lesbian, I would say nightclub, but that's not appropriate for the time.
Kind of like a speakeasy.
Yeah, like a speakeasy.
Yeah.
And how Edith couldn't dance. It was very sweet.
It was very sweet. I also just loved the mini like interactions you get with them. I think it really colors how comfortable they are in their relationship. For instance, she was talking about how she was developing the film from the crime scene that she took after mm-hmm. she did a ritual to be able to see the bloodshed and everything from the crime scene.
Mm-hmm.
And she was having trouble getting a clear image on the one. And she was talking to Edith about it and everything. And Edith's like, well, okay, well, after I get done at the church, because she's a very religious woman, she's constantly going to church. She's like, after I get back from this, I'll see if I can work on it and everything. And it's the comfort level with their relationship of, oh, but we'll work on that together. You know, I really appreciated those mm-hmm. little touches.
I also feel like when they started talking about San Francisco, my little heart was just kind of like, oh no, you're not going to make it to San Francisco.
I know, I did too. I was like, oh no,
sounds so nice.
There were a couple of times where like, obviously they're talking about San Francisco and not Santa Fe, but I kept hearing Santa Fe.
Yes.
My old friends. I was like, no, get it together.
Wait, that if it makes you feel better, I did the same thing and literally like in the middle of it was like, damn it, Newsies, get out of there.
Right. Yeah. It was very cute that they had this like big plan. And so when you find out that it's like, just kidding, I'm gonna die, you're like, bitch, no.
Wait a minute. Were you referencing Newsies and not Rent?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh. If I was referencing Rent, it would have been, do you know the way?
Listen, you just said Santa Fe in a singy voice. And because I have not seen the Newsies, the musical version.
Oh, it's so good.
I only heard Rent.
In the movie, it's Christian Bale as a youth, if you will. And he's singing basically to the night that all he wants to do is to escape to Santa Fe where he won't be treated like shit. It's very sad, very sweet, very mournful, very aspirational. It's a beautiful number.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
The vibe is pretty much the same.
It is,
too.
It is. Although, Newsies came first, I'm pretty sure.
Yes.
Fair enough.
So, yeah.
Because once again, Christian Bale as a youth.
Yeah. Big crush on him as a child. Uh-huh. Between Newsies and Little Women, I was like, I don't know what I'm feeling, but I like this boy.
He's in so many things when he was younger, too.
And then he became the Batmans.
And then he mm-hmm, became the mm-hmm, Batmans.
Mm-hmm. And that was nice, too. But it's no Laurie from Little Women. It's just
I don't love him as much in Swing Kids because, you know,
He's not the good guy
in that one. But he did very good.
He did
a wonderful performance, but he does make me want to throat punch him.
Anyway.
I'm not a part of this conversation. I don't know what you're talking about. Anyway.
We clearly need to show you more Christian Bale youth movies, is what I heard.
Absolutely.
You know I'm not going to watch it.
You will if I hold you down.
Because that's always worked so well.
Wiggles, we're going to have a kidnap Liz weekend.
Dun, dun, dun.
It can't be next weekend, though, because I'm going to go sleep in my tree house.
I'll tell you this right now.
It can't be the weekend after that either.
If you ever attempt to surprise me with an activity when I was planning to not people, I will kick you out of my house so goddamn fast.
No, we know better.
We'll bait
than
and
that.
Switch you.
That's more acceptable.
It'll be like, oh, come over and we'll talk about this thing. And then it'll be like, I would like to introduce you to Newsies.
And then the next Swing Kids.
Yeah.
Not a big, like, let's hang out and watch movies together thing.
And then we're going to trap you in, like, the chair, like, from, what is it?
Can't help you with this one, kid.
The one where they, like, clamp their eyes open.
Oh, orange something.
Orange.
Something orange? Orange. Orange.
Shit.
Fuck. It's the fucking. I have seen that movie.
Clockwork Orange?
Clockwork Orange, yes. Clockwork Orange. I've seen that movie.
I haven't seen that one movie.
I have seen that movie.
I was just trying to figure out movies with orange in the name.
Anyway.
And then you'll fall in love with Christian Bale too.
Like, probably not in the same way that you guys did, though, because I'm past the age of that.
No. You won't get transported back into your, like, 12-year-old body going, no. Oh, my God.
Oh, Christian Bale.
He's so cute. Why doesn't Joe pick him? It doesn't make sense. And then, like, you read it, like, watch it as an adult, and you're like, absolutely not. If I was Joe, I would have throat punched him. What the fuck?
I have not read or watched A Little Women. We should talk about this book.
Don't make me put Little Women on the list because I'll fucking do it.
So you can put, you can make whatever fucking. Oh, you mean the list for this?
Yes.
Yeah, but then we probably have to watch the new one.
No, fuck that. No.
I mean, for the sake of like doing something that people would actually listen to,
we would read the book. It's not hard to read.
I didn't say it was hard to read. I just don't want to. Anyway.
First of all, you're wrong.
Let me rephrase this. It's not that I don't want to read it. It's that I don't want to read it.
Yeah, and that makes you wrong.
Let's talk about this, Mike.
I will argue with you about this later. So let's talk about the elephant in the room.
Do it.
There were no vampires.
There were no vampires.
None at all. Nary a vampire.
I was so looking forward to, like, hot lesbian vampire necking, and there was none of it.
That was not what it was. I will say that. I don't know what I was expecting other than it was a detective story. I got that from the vibe.
Yeah.
But they were like, the White City Vampire. And I was like, ooh, who's she gonna be?
Hot. Who's she?
And no, it's just some old grumpy angel who's like, well, I can't get to heaven. It sucks. I'm gonna kill a bunch of people.
Asshole.
Pretty rude.
Which I suppose you just did the transition of the entire detective part, which is which is we find out the White City Vampire is the angel Sasha.
Sashiel.
It's not
Sashiel.
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 If we say it enough times, it will no longer have meaning. Sashiel.
See, the problem with reading the physical copy and not stopping to figure out what the pronunciations of names are is either the name gets nothing. So, like, I just read it and go bleh in mm-hmm. my mind. Or it gets a new name. Mm-hmm. And Sashiel became Sasha.
I also do that. Yes. If it makes you feel better. I'm like, sure, your name is now Mark.
And then I kept thinking of Sasha Conan. What was
Sasha
his?
Conan Baron?
Yeah, which I am pretty sure is not the image.
No, not at all.
I don't think Borat was what they were going for.
But I mean, you could also envision him in, like, a priest outfit being
okay.
Kinda...
But now I can, and I now know. That's all I can picture. So
yelling at people. Getting shot a lot in the face and yet still
functioning. That character is no longer scary to me anymore. Because all I'm picturing is Borat's voice delivering the lines. And then if they were successful, going, very nice.
That's not the only, like, voice he uses.
That's true. Well, no, his voice is a little bit different in Talladega Nights because he's French.
He's also played serious roles.
I'm sure. I haven't seen them.
Okay. Anyway.
Isn't he also in Sweeney Todd?
Yeah.
He plays the... I don't know.
He's in Les Mis.
He's in both, isn't he?
He's in both.
Is he in both?
So, Sachel. Sachel?
Sachel.
Sachel.
Not you're... Sasha. is this bad angel bro who has been finding all of the victims, isn't the right word, but the humans who have made these crossroad deals, and is killing them right before their 10 years are up, and then their soul goes to the devils. So essentially,
again, was a supernatural plot point,
right? Well, yeah. Yeah. And so that is the whole like detective plot. And at one point, Helen and Haranyo, the angel, went to the asylum to visit one of the victims, because on top of it, to make matters even worse, because it's like one thing to kill people who are literally about like days away from dying anyway. But the big bad thing that he does is he forcefully enters people who are hosts. So like, and in the process of doing that, causes them to go insane.
And when he leaves their body, well, they leave their body.
Yeah.
They're kind of gender neutral. They leave them behind, like, with no direction, no coherent understanding of where they are. One of the people he leaves behind, she's like, wakes up just covered in blood without a scratch on her, is what the witnesses they talk to say, right? And so he just abandons them to, like...
to take the fall for what he did.
Yeah.
Except their minds are also just, like, fucked up.
Yeah.
Because, like, this... possession essentially is what it is. When angels do it, they need to ask permission, which is why Haranyo possesses or shares Edith's body. And so when we meet Miranda, I think is her name, the gal that he essentially body snatched to go kill people, she is just gone.
Yep.
Like, there's nothing in her head.
Well, and it's a big deal because Haranyo makes a big stink about how possession is with an angel is different from a demon, where a demon will just leave you to deal with the mess.
Yeah.
And angels don't. And so the whole time they think they're looking for a demon because of this, because what angel would do this, right?
Yeah.
And so there's that contradiction of what is good, what is evil, which is a running theme throughout the book, but also is a red herring.
Yeah.
That scene in the asylum when the doctor is talking to her mother about possibly putting her into electric shock, and he's like, you need to take this home to your husband, blah blah blah. I have never wanted to throat punch somebody so bad.
Yeah, that is the one thing I found interesting, because this book is so short, the things that the author did choose to put in. And one of them is this entirely separate conversation where the doctor is telling Miranda, I think that's her name, her mother, that she needs to take this form home so that her husband can like sign off on the electric shock. And even though the mom is asking all these questions like, will this hurt her? What is going to happen? He was just like, that's for your husband to worry about.
Well, it's a very historically accurate conversation.
Oh, it is. It just makes it very abundantly clear that I could not ever in the 1930s, because I would have punched somebody.
Well, we're not that far removed is the thing.
Yeah, no,
it's really easy to get comfortable here, but you know, it wasn't until the 70s that you could have your own bank account and credit card, things like that. So, you know, I think that the author is doing a lot of smart insertion of certain moments to call out what they want their message to be.
Absolutely.
Well, and the second call out in that scenario is when they run into Harriet, who is another woman who participated in the speakeasy and prefers women, and is also gone because they've just fried her brain with aversion therapy via electric shock. And that was terrible. But while we're talking about the asylum, the one thing I noted that really kind of like made me feel like another reference to another thing that this author is pulling on is some of the people in the asylum recognize Haranyo inside of Edith's body. Like they have a reaction to him. And that reminded me so much of John Constantine when they're like talking about the bodies that have been possessed by angels and demons, and how certain people who are a little bit closer to being like a prophet or something like that can see them and usually end up in asylums because they're going crazy because they can see like essentially the other worlds bleeding into ours.
Right. Well, and I think it's in that scene that we get a little lore drop from Helen acknowledging that even though you require a male family member to sort of vouch for you in this magical order, that more women than men often have these abilities and have this link. And so the asylums essentially are full of these women who are cast aside.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Gross.
Very much so.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that is another thing. Since you talked about like the people who have this magic or whatever, we find out from Harrenhal that the people who have magic are descendants of Nephilim, which are people born with angel blood, kind of essentially. And the whole reason that some of the angels were cast out of heaven and are stuck on earth now is because they became too close to humans and like gave a piece of themselves to these humans, which then created this whole subspecies, I guess.
Essentially a magical bloodlines.
Yeah, which then also brings up like a question that doesn't really get asked or talked about too much in the book of like, was that the right punishment for the angels who were being tasked with being on Earth to protect humans and guide them, be guardian angels, whatever? And was because they got too close to their charges, they got cast out of heaven?
Well, I think one of the weaknesses of the way the lore is built, and I get why it's built the way it's built, because it gives it a certain level of neutrality when it comes to religious practice.
Yeah.
But there's no indication of if there is God or gods, right? And there's really no indication of if the Morning Star exists, Lucifer. Right. And all we get from Harrenhal is that they didn't fall. They were cast out, right? So it wasn't a mistake that they made, it was a consequence. Right. And so without that, what authority cast them out? Right. So it's like the consequence of keeping the religious iconography, I guess is the best I can come up with at this moment, neutral, is that there's just what is the authority that is able to do this? What authority has given you this power? Obviously this would be in a post Jesus world. So did Jesus exist? Are the saints real, right? Like things like that, like none of that's really explored. And again, a very, very short book, and I get why they made that choice. I just think it's sort of it leaves major holes. And that's the consequence too of relying on existing lore and not building your own, right?
I thought that God was mentioned a few times, but it may have also just been by Helen, who would have just had
the vaguest idea.
Yeah.
Right.
But hell is something that is only talked about in the vaguest terms.
Right.
Like, what even is hell in this world?
Well, and to be fair, I won't speak for other religions, but the Catholic idea of hell has changed a lot over the years. They like to pretend like it's always been the way that they perceive it now. No, it hasn't. There was a whole time where before everyone could read and the gospel would be read to them in church, that there were these special ceremonies where they would have people dress up as like devils and drag them into hell holes. And it's like one of the origins of what we conceptualize theater as now. Anyway, I'm a nerd, but my point is,
you don't have to tell us that, we've met you.
Yeah, but maybe the people at home are listening for the first time to this episode. You never know. But my point to all of that is that hell is probably the most vague of that dogma of what it really is. And so I do understand that having almost an air of mystery to it, because there's kind of this idea that nobody who goes there comes back. Mm-hmm. Right? And anybody who would know, like, a demon who's on Earth isn't going to give you the satisfaction of knowing. I can justify that, but not but you have angels right there who are quote unquote supposed to be truthful.
Yeah.
They wouldn't and so it feels like they would number one have that knowledge and number two would act with it. Mm-hmm. And so it feels like their characters are sort of shortchanged because you're not giving them that information because you're not acknowledging that information.
Yeah, you're right.
Sometimes I do a smart do.
Sometimes. Sometimes brain does do good.
Sometimes brain does words combination sentence.
So there is a scene, a particular scene that I did want to talk about, and it's the diner scene where, you know, they've been going all night doing this investigation. The angel has been in possession of Edith's body, and Helen's like, bitch, I gotta eat. And so they go to this diner, and before they walk in, she said, put Edith's ring on. And so basically they both have fake wedding rings that they put on when they go in this diner when they're on a date, and they basically pretend that they are two widowed friends there to have a chat and have dinner and everything. And the length that they have to go to not appear like they are a couple really hurt me, because I know that is a reality of stuff that happened when, you know, in the 30s and everything, because it was against the law to be with someone of the opposite sex. Same sex.
That's okay.
If only. No, just kidding. I'm totally joking because I am stupidly straight and I hate it. But it was so heartbreaking to me because that is something that they did. That was a reality.
Well, they drop little bits and pieces of it. So when they're at the diner, Helen is thinking, should we have gone to a different place where people don't know Edith? Because when Harnell is possessing her body, she looks and acts weird because it's another fucking person, essentially, entity, whatever. Mm-hmm. But then she's also like, but then we'd have to act different. And at the very least here, they know us and we don't have to worry that people are going to be like,
what's going on?
Like questioning this. They've gotten used to this like system we've created.
Mm-hmm. Well, and she talks about jumping in to prevent Harnell from having to try and cover for the fact that she is definitely not Edith, and this waitress knows she's not would know Edith well enough that if she talked with her too much, she'd be like, that's not right.
Yeah.
And it's never expressly said, but it's definitely heavily implied that she is used to having to look at it from all angles of what other people are seeing.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
On the other side of it, they do show us a really positive representation with the speakeasy.
Yes.
Right? So it's this community, like there's a running gag of Helen flirting with the coat check girl or something like that? I can't remember. Cigarette girl?
One of the two, yeah.
Something like that. Like, yeah. You know, it's this comfortable, easy place that they can all be together, which is really nice.
Which is why when they talk about San Francisco, they do it in this very like almost dreamlike and wishful fashion of like, what would it be like to actually buy a house together instead of having to like secret away to our apartment? Mm-hmm. And what would it be like to not have to be scared at every turn that you're gonna get caught?
I do also like, and we only get to have it for a minute before shit starts hitting the fan in this story, because it goes like splick splack, we're on to the next thing, right? Yeah. But that night they do get to be together, and it does fade to black, so we don't really know too much. But the next morning, or whenever they wake up, I don't know if it was morning or whatever.
When her brother broke in.
Yeah. Well, actually, before that, Edith is like up in her robe, camisole thing, whatever it was in the story, like is basically falling off. And Helen's like, you're really going to tell me to get up when you're naked in front of me? Like, bold assumption. I think I'm going to stay right here.
Yeah. And she's also feeding the birds, which is a really sweet scene. And then you realize that Harnell has been like basically cultivating a flocks of birds to be his like little spies and informants. And I'm just kind of like, was that fully Edith in that moment?
I would love more lore on this, yeah. But my impression of that was that Edith isn't always there. She's yep. not always at home, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think the moments where she's like, oh, I've had a vision or whatever. They have a very specific name for it in the book, and I can't think of it.
But it's when she can read people's thoughts.
Yes.
But I don't know what I don't remember what they called it.
Yeah. I think inkling is what jumps into my head, but that might be totally off base. But that when she has one of these moments... that's just Harnyell saying, we need to go do this thing. I genuinely believe that's what's happening there. And that's why she's so cagey about what she's doing.
Yeah. There are times when she can actually hear people's thoughts because it does happen to Helen. Mm-hmm. But Harnyell can also do it. So it's like, was it Harnyell saying, mm-hmm. like, this is what she's thinking right now? Was it Edith? Are the lines between the two even that distinct, or have they become blurred that like, yes, when Edith is in full control, she's Edith. When Harnyell is full control, it's Harnyell. But like, they can hear each other, they can interact in her head. So are the lines always that clear as to when who is who?
I think they blur is kind of the impression I got, is they kind of just are living together as one entity to a degree. They can separate from each other by taking over, taking control or whatever, but I think they blur most of the time, and so they kind of almost become one entity in those moments.
Just like in The Host by Stephenie Meyer.
I don't think you need to invoke Stephenie Meyer in this moment.
Yeah, no.
I actually do remember really liking that book when I was younger, but I haven't read it since high school.
I didn't think the movie was that bad.
I never saw the movie.
But I do want to talk about there is a conversation between Harnyell and Helen where it's revealed that Harnyell knows exactly how it feels when they're getting busy.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
So I do think that our read of things, that it is very blurry where those lines exist, mm-hmm. Is right, because otherwise how would you know? And there is a read of Harnyell being mad at Helen for giving up her soul at the end, as being mad of being separated from Edith for whatever time she has on Earth. Mm-hmm. I read that as her being mad that she will never see Helen again.
Mm-hmm. That's fair, because like Edith says that she was very young when she first, I guess, like interacted with Harnyell. Mm-hmm. And I imagine that it also happened when she was at least a teenager, when they fully kind of like
combined.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So
they've been together for the entirety of Edith and Helen's relationship at that point. So I think they've equal points fallen in love with Helen a little bit too.
I think so. Right. Like, I don't think Helen knew it, but I think she was in a throuple.
Yep. I love that the description of, because Helen asks Harnyell, wait a minute, are you there when we do... when we go to the sexy times? She doesn't say sexy times, but that's what she means. Basically, the description is just that Harnyell, like, they turn away when it happens. They just look the other direction. Like, I don't think that's how it works.
Yeah. Well, and like, you know, you can tell that Helen would really like to pick at that some more. Like, the detective in her is like, okay, but wait.
But we're going to revisit that.
And just never gets the chance. I'm pretty sure that there's a conversation after all of the, like, romantic getting down. Because they're getting down after this. Like,
oh, for sure.
You sacrificed your soul again. We've got 10 years. We got 10 years to fill. Okay?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go buy a house because I've got $5,000 in 1930s.
Yeah. We're living up these 10 years, right?
Six.
Six
grand.
She just got a grand for
her. Like, for this situation.
No, Danny, it was 10 years.
No, 10 years, $6,000 though.
Yeah.
But
I feel like there's afterwards, while they're lying in bed, there's got to be a moment where they turn to each other and they're like, questions that I have for you are a lot. Uh-huh. So let's start with this one.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
You know, one character we have not talked about at all is Marlo.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The benefactor of Helen going out and doing all of this detective work.
Well, essentially, she is a loan service provider who has picked up someone else's loan.
Yes.
and so she's just like, yeah, sure, fuck it, I'll take this debt. And so this whole time, apparently, of their partnership together, she's owned Helen's, like, IOU for a soul, and I think has grown to like Helen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And maybe even like Helen.
Oh yeah.
I got vibes there.
I got vibes.
Yeah. Right. And so I like, she talks about at the end that she's like, just let me be very clear. No other human has gotten out of a deal mm-hmm. with any demon ever. I made you a one-time exclusive deal. And she's like, nope, give me Edith. Right? But I think, like, genuinely, in spite of her being very cagey with information, if you will, I think she was kind of being a friend. Like, she was...
Oh,
for
sure.
She was offering this off as, like, you know what? I like this one. I'm gonna... Let's try it out. Let's see what happens if you give a mortal their soul back.
Well, and she's also become very useful to her. I totally agree. She likes her.
Mm-hmm.
She was trying to be a pal. Mm-hmm. But I also think she's also become very useful to her in every situation. So she's like, oh, well, I could keep you around longer.
Mm-hmm.
Because obviously she has, even if they did move to San Francisco.
She's a damn demon.
She's a damn demon. She can materialize. Who's to say she doesn't already have a house in San Francisco?
Right.
Right.
And when Helen is doing the second deal for Edith's life, Marlo pauses for a second. Instead of being a greedy demon, devil, whatever, mm-hmm. and going, yeah, I'm going to take this deal. I'm going to, like,
mm-hmm.
now I'm actually going to get your soul again. She literally pauses and it says, what you said, you're not going to get out of this again.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you need to think about this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then when they make the deal, she read this.
Mm-hmm.
Marlo knelt in blood, caught my chin, and gave me a gentle, lingering kiss.
Aww.
That's how they sealed the deal. It's very cute.
It is. I think if she had her way, she would have a little bit of Helen.
Oh, yeah.
I think she's probably going to be fine going after Ted, because when they go back to her skyrise apartment or whatever, mm-hmm. and Ted is all naked because he was supposed to be the last sacrifice.
That's one thing we forgot to talk about a little bit is at the end, during the sacrifice part, he's just butt-ass naked.
Yeah. He's just butt-ass naked, chained to the floor, trying to get out.
Yes. And at one point, Helen's like, you know, if Edith was bothered by meeting my brother butt-ass naked for the first time, she's doing a really good job of hiding it.
Well, because they were hugging too.
Yes.
Yeah.
She's on that the floor junk's hugging just out Edith, there. And then Ted comes up and hugs both of them, and he is butt-ass naked.
How else are you supposed to do a human sacrifice ritual to gain enough soul power to summon Michael the Archangel down to open the gates of hell for you? I mean, come on.
I mean, you can't do that with clothes on.
No.
I mean,
you got to go out the world exactly you came in.
Apparently some cotton is against the thought process on that. Or whatever.
You can't be having, like, cotton getting in the way when you got to slice and dice. Catches on the knife in an unpleasant way.
Yeah, well.
Yeah.
Anyway, Marlo takes them back to her high-rise apartment after everything's gone down and is like, don't worry, you can take a bath in my giant bath, which we have seen her in previously, the giant bath.
Mm-hmm. Which, jealous.
Yeah. I know, right?
I literally, when they said it, I was like, I want to go to there.
Yeah, I was like, can I have a demon be my best friend who has a Skyrise apartment in Chicago with a giant bath that can fit like 5 people? Because I want that.
I mean,
I don't want 5 other people in the bath.
No, but I want a bathtub that fits 5 other people.
Yes.
She was giving me the same energy as the Morrigan from Lost Girl.
Yes. Yes, she was.
If you've ever watched that. And I was just like, the part that like immediately tipped me into that visual was there's a line that's something like, she threw back the last sip of champagne but did not make a face that implied that she enjoyed it, and I was like, god damn.
Damn it, now I need to watch that TV show again. It's been way too long.
Oh, I've never yeah. seen it. You should. I will say it's both bad and good.
Yeah.
I mean, it's fair enough.
Equally bad as it is good.
Yes. Yes. But, you know, I definitely had the feeling that if somebody was going to take my soul, it might as well be her. That's you know?
Fair. Right.
Like, all right, mommy. Oh no. You can't say she was not giving off mommy vibes.
Oh, for sure.
Oh yeah. No,
that's why I'm saying when she takes everybody back to her place and Ted is like still fucking naked, I'm like, she is gonna go after that man.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he's, like we talked about, apparently already 4 foot to hell. Maybe, we don't really know.
Mm-hmm.
So I could see him going for it, just being like, fuck it.
Yeah.
What else can happen?
Like, what are you going to do? You're going to be like, oh, you killed an angel and you also slept with a demon. Like, which of those two is going to be the tipping of the
right.
scales?
Right.
You know? Yeah. I like her as a character.
Mm-hmm.
Quite a bit. I want just her story, maybe. I
would love that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Especially because Ted is now kicked out of the Brotherhood.
Uh-huh.
And he's going to do a little detective work with Helen.
Uh-huh.
So I'm guessing he's also moving to San Francisco.
This is what I'm saying. This book needs to be the start of a series,
yeah.
not a mm-hmm. standalone.
Correct.
Yes.
It needs to be like adventures with our team, our new Scooby gang, if you will. So
I want that.
Yeah. If you could do that, that'd be super great.
CL Polk.
If you could give us a series, we would read it and yeah. enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
Hop on it.
That honestly,
San Francisco. Like, hop on it.
Hop on it. If you cut that out, Danny, I'll be upset.
I think that's a great way to end the episode.
It really is. Let's transition into some ratings, eh?
Yeah.
Spice rating? It's a big old goose egg, right?
It is a big old goose egg.
I think I could, if they give us just like a little bit more, I would be able to justify it at 0.5, but I gotta go goose egg.
Well, we didn't even get really much of a kiss between Helen and Edith, even.
We didn't even get a good goose. Just a little pinch on the bottom. You know what I'm saying?
I do know what you're saying.
And there were yes. multiple bottoms available.
There's a lot of people that I would be fine doing pinching too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just a little goose.
Consensual goose. But
yeah. Well.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Romance.
The romance.
So I liked that they had an established relationship and everything. It really wasn't so much about the romance, but I kind of give it like a 3 because I like the established relationship. It feels like a comfortable relationship and it seems a logical reason for her to give up her soul in order to continue on this relationship.
I think if this was a movie, it would be a 5.
Yeah.
Because it would take us on an appropriately linked journey of
yeah.
their romance. But I think because it is a book, I'm so used to having more.
Mm-hmm.
I want more Edith. I want more Helen. I want more of them together. And like, kind of that's the theme of this book, is wanting more.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna say like a 3.5. I'm gonna give a little sprinkle extra. Because I did really like the two of them together.
Mm-hmm. I think it's the ending for me that gives that extra 0.5. So mm-hmm. I'm also doing the 3.5 just because the ending was so romantic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And just the last line, like that last line gutted
right?
me.
Right. I was wondering when she was going to deliver the, even though I knew the end, right? And mm-hmm. I was like, oh, is this not going to end happy? Oh my God, are they not going to have and then it was like, okay, they have a happy ending.
Yeah.
Question mark.
Mm.
Well, she mentions it in the middle a little bit when they're talking about the Great Gatsby.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the very end when they're talking about having the next 10 years together, even though she knows the end
mm-hmm.
in 10 years.
Right.
It hurt me.
It did hurt.
Yep. It hurt me too.
So your overall rating?
I gave it a 3 on Goodreads, but as we know, Goodreads doesn't let you do points. So a 3.5 for me.
Mm-hmm.
I really liked this book. It was just real short and I want more.
I think I'm going to go with a 4. I'm going to stick with my gut.
Uh-huh.
So a 4 is my overall.
I this is another one of those where I'm like, it's like a 3.75.
Yeah. Yep.
It's good. It's mm-hmm. really good. I just want like so much more of it.
Yeah.
So fully acknowledging short stories aren't my thing, I'm going to give it a 3.5.
Well, I was kind of there too.
Mm-hmm.
Between like, is it a 3.5? Is it a 4? Where does it land? And so I just rounded up.
But it also doesn't feel right. Like, I'm gonna just stick with what I said.
Just stick with what I said.
And you know what? The vibes may be different later. And then I'll just change my rating on Goodreads.
Yeah, the amount of times that I look back on something and either increase it because I'm like, oh yeah, I did really like that. Or I'm like, wait a minute. Mm-hmm. Why the fuck did I rate it that high? No, it happens a lot. So what are your guys' recommendations?
So I mentioned it earlier, but I think you should listen to the 1930s radio show, The Shadow.
Mm-hmm.
It's detective-y. It has a little bit of the paranormal because the whole premise is that he can kind of hypnotize people to not notice him.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's the shadow. He can cloud the minds of men. It's really funny and cracks me up every single time. And then there's this demonic laugh that scares the shit out of some people. One of our friends was asleep in my car driving back from the cities, and I had been listening to The Shadow, and he woke up because the whole thing goes, who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? The Shadow knows. And then there's this like laugh thing, and he woke up. He's like, what the fuck is that? But it has a very detective-y vibe and everything, and I just really appreciate it, and I got those vibes from this book. So
fair enough. Aside from all of the references we made to other media throughout the entire episode here, I would recommend the Hollow series by Kim Harrison for a modern paranormal twist on it, because it's the main character is a witch who's kind of been ostracized and decides to open her own detective business in Cincinnati with her vampire roommate and the pixie that lives in her garden. But it has romance elements but really it's just about them and their detective business. And there's like 16 damn books at this point. So you get the full breadth of like shifters and demons and all sorts of things. So I'd go for that.
Nice.
Good choice. So mine's a little bit of an oddball.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the 7th series of Doctor Who, there is a couple, Madame Vestra, I can't remember, and Jenny Flint.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like this sort of like, if you know Doctor Who, his companions are all like a little bit adventure seeking. But they're also like this mysterious couple in the shadows because so Madame Vestra is kind of like a lizard woman.
Okay.
And so she has this like dark veil and they're amazing. But the whole time I was kind of getting the vibes of the similar couple of like the one who's like, I'm going to go off and I'm going to like be a detective. And the other one who's like, okay, be safe and don't do stupid things, please.
Yeah, very much so.
And so, yes, you would have to start in the middle of shenanigans in order to get to them. So like I said, it's a very like off-beaten path, but you know, you should just watch Doctor Who anyway. So
indeed,
there you go.
This isn't a recommendation, but the other show that I kind of got like vibes for reading this book was The Dresden Files.
I don't think I've ever watched that.
Me either.
Well, I'll keep that to myself then.
Okay. I have a lot of those shows where I'm like, I'm just waiting for an opportunity to meet somebody who has also seen them. Because I watch some weird shit sometimes.
Fair enough. All right. Well, that's the end, folks. So if you like this episode, please find us out there on the socials at Wrong Dust Jackets, or go to our website at wrongdustjackets.com. You can find all of the episodes that we're going to be doing for season 2, or at least several of them. And you can check out our blog, which has more book reviews of things that we haven't done episodes about. And if you are out on whatever podcast listening app you're on, please give us 5 stars. That would be much appreciated. Drop a comment if that's available to you. Or just reach out on the internet and let us know what you think. We'd love to hear from you. That's all I got. Bye, folks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.